amputated, and that's supposed to be 70% effective. These are medicines that are used in many other countries besides Cuba, and by and large have not been available to people in the U.S. So they're working hard. There's inefficiencies in terms of getting to work at home and getting the equipment to do the testing, which is often embargoed as well. Getting spare parts is a headache in every field of Cuban technology and equipment that are imported from other countries. But they've made tremendous breakthroughs, and U.S. and Cuba are the only countries in this hemisphere to develop vaccines. Cubans are making a world impact now.
Art, there were demonstrations of a few thousand in Havana and various cities on the island on July 11th this past summer. What were the motivations for these protests? Who participated? Who organized them? And what were their demands?
Well, it was a little diverse in terms of what the demands were, but clearly a major factor was the intense dissatisfaction with the shortage of food, which, as I indicated, is and has been severe, with some lack of progress by what Cubans expect from their health system in terms of dealing with COVID-19. COVID-19 was tiny in Cuba.
Art, there were supposed to be other demonstrations, both in the United States and in Cuba, on November 15th, but those didn't materialize. Please talk about this and the new organization of young people called the Red Scarves, who support the revolution but have constructive criticisms.
You know, history will tell us more in terms of the exact involvement of U.S. planning, etc. The circumstantial involvement is clear. November 15, basically nobody came out reporting in places like the New York Times, you know, talks about this huge police state crackdown preventing it, which to some degree was a factor, but by and large it was the Cubans' lack of interest in any large scale in having these street protests because they do not see them really going anywhere. And this was timed, either on purpose or otherwise, to coincide with the opening of foreign tourism on November 15 and the return of some 600,000 students to personal in-class education, which, because of the pandemic, had been limited to television, etc.
Art, thank you so much for this great interview and for your tireless work for the Cuban people who are under constant onslaught by the United States.
Thank you, Art Heitzer. We certainly appreciate your good work and your being on Law and Disorder. Take it easy.
You as well.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Excuse me, who am I? Hello? Why am I here? What's my purpose in life? What do I mean by who am I?
Now calm down, get a grip now. Oh, this is an interesting sensation.
What is it? It's a sort of yawning, tingling sensation in my, well, I suppose I better start finding names for things if I want to make any headway in what, for the sake of what I shall call an argument, I shall call the world. So, let's call it my stomach. So, a yawning, tingling sensation in my stomach. Good. Whoa, it's getting quite strong. And hey, what about this whistling, roaring sound going past what I'm suddenly going to call my head? That can be wind. Is that a good name? Well, it'll do. Perhaps I can find a better name for it later when I find out what it's for, because there certainly seems to be a hell of a lot of it. Hey, what's this thing? This, let's call it, tail. Yeah, tail. Hey, I can really thrash it out pretty good, can't I? Wow! Wow! Hey! Doesn't seem to achieve much, but I'll probably find out what it's for later on. Now, have I built up any coherent picture of things yet? No. Oh, well, hey, this is really exciting. So much to find out about, so much to look forward to. I'm quite dizzy with anticipation. Or is it the wind?
Hey, there really is a lot of that now, isn't there? And wow, what's this thing coming towards me very fast? Very, very fast. So big and flat and wide. It needs a big, light-sounding sort of word like round. Ground! That's it! Ground!
Society that has failed the most vulnerable among us, a society whose protean forms of racism and slavery have never changed. Prisons are plantations. They are run like plantations, with white overseers and people of color enslaved, because no prison functions unless the work is done by prisoners.
That's Chris Hedges, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Chris Hedges on the prison plantation system. The 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution in 1865 officially abolished slavery. However, there is a crucial legal exception. Section 1 of the amendment provides, "Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction." In plain English, this simply means those behind bars have no constitutional rights and they can be forced to work as further punishment for their crimes. They earn, if you can even say that, little or no money. It's a new form of slavery. The plantation system is tragically alive and well. Blacks, Latinx, and indigenous make up a disproportionate percentage of those incarcerated. Many of them were coerced in plea deals. In this program, Chris Hedges describes the effort of some prisoners to educate themselves. Chris Hedges is an award-winning journalist who has reported from the Balkans, the Middle East, and Central America. Cornel West calls him the greatest radical writer and journalist of our generation. He writes a weekly column for SheerPost.com, and he's the host of On Contact on RTTV. He's the author of many books, including Death of the Liberal Class, Wages of Rebellion, and Our Class, Trauma and Transformation in an American Prison. He spoke at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. And now, Chris Hedges.
I've taught in the New Jersey prison system now for a decade. I first began teaching in the prison system before there was a college program. Now there is students can earn their college degree from Rutgers University. But when I went in, it was that program wasn't there. It was composed of a handful of us, led by the chairman of the history department of the College of New Jersey, Celia Chazelle. We would teach semester-long courses. We would buy the books for our students ourselves. We had no academic accreditation, so if people completed the coursework, we would go home to our printers and print out certificates that said that they had done the work and put it in their files to hopefully help them when they reached the probation board to show that they had used their time inside prison wisely and, you know, to try and develop their own learning without the structure of a university. I had been teaching at a youth correction facility called Wagner, and in 2013, Rutgers began its program, and I went to East Jersey State Prison in Rahway, New Jersey, and the first class I taught was one on drama, and we read plays by August Wilson and Amira Baraka and Leroy Jones, his classic work, Dutchman. We read Panero, we read the brother-sister plays, and when I first went into that classroom of 28 students, I didn't know what level to expect. And I began teaching. I like very much Michelle Alexander's great work, The New Jim Crow. In every prison that I've taught in several prisons in the state of New Jersey, including the women's prison. I bring in copies of that book, even if I'm not teaching it for the course, because I think the power of the book is that it explains to students caught up in a rigged judicial system that it's not just them, it's not just their friends, it's not just their neighbors, but it's that the entire system has been gamed against them. Because, of course, most people in the American prison system never get a jury trial. And that's not an accident. That's by design. 94% of the people in our prison system, and let's acknowledge that we have the largest prison system in the world, 25% of the world's prisoners, and we are 4.4% of the world's population. So they don't get a jury trial, and they are coerced, and I don't use the word coerced lightly. They are coerced into accepting a plea. How does that work? They stack you with a series of charges, most of which they know you did not commit. One of the favorite ones in the state of New Jersey is kidnapping, which is 25 years. And that's the one they're always willing to lift. And so you have a kind of negotiations between the public prosecutors who never spend more than 15 or 20 minutes on a case, the public defense attorneys, and people, even if they are innocent of the crime to which they are charged, are forced to plea out, because if they don't, then all of those charges are leveled against them. And one of the tragedies in the prison system is that, and I've now taught that several hundred students in the system, is that those with the longest sentences invariably did not commit the crime, because they still believed, because they were innocents, they could go to court and get a fair trial. And in fact, when you go to trial, because the system is designed to make sure that you don't go to trial, because if everyone went to trial, the entire system would break down. It's not capable of carrying out that number of jury trials. They have to make an example of you. And the example becomes they give you these horrific sentences, enhanced sentences, life plus 50 kind of stuff. And then they use you. They say, oh, you want to go to trial? Well, look at John, or, you know, look at Sabir, or look at whoever. And it works. The other issue, of course, are RICO laws, which were done to round up the mob. So one of the students in the class, a guy named Boris Franklin, who was the first student who got out from that class, I met him at the gate with his mother and his sister. He was in a room. There was an altercation. It was a drug deal. Went bad. Somebody got shot. He didn't shoot the guy. He didn't know the guy who got shot. He was not, but because he was in the room, if you don't immediately call 911, everybody in that room gets charged. And he was basically a single dad raising his son, and he goes off to prison. And when he gets out, his son is in prison because he had no structure. In fact, tragically, his son was in prison and was beaten to death by his cellmate. And so I walked into that class, and I didn't know what to expect. Most people in the class had very little experience with drama. And this, of course, is part of the tragedy of a country that refuses to fund its arts, so that August Wilson, arguably perhaps the 20th century's greatest playwright, certainly one of the top two or three, when he produces Fences or Joe Turner Come and Gone or any of these other great plays that he wrote, these students don't have $150 to go on buy a ticket on Broadway and see it. So I taught, just because I want people to understand first and foremost how the system works, I taught Michelle Alexander's book, and I could see these were older. I taught in the youth correction facility, but older students in the prison, people who've done 10, 15 years already, who are in their 30s, 40s, even 50s, that's a different class. Very wary, very careful. One of the things we are all aware of when we teach in the prison is that the prison authorities put snitches in the class to report on the teachers, to report on the students, and the students were very careful. Very few of them had even seen a play. And on that first class, I said, well, when we finish with Michelle Alexander, I think we spent 3 or 4 classes on it, we're going to begin to write plays. And it was not premeditated, but I suggested that they write in dramatic form so that they would begin to have a kind of understanding of how playwrights write. And I said, you know, write scenes from your own life, whether before you were in prison, when you were in prison, and think how people speak to you. When someone, how does someone speak when they are feeling grief? Or how do you speak to someone who is grieving? Do you speak to a corrections officer the same way you speak to a fellow prisoner? Do you speak to a white person the same way you speak to a black person? How do you speak to someone when you want something from them? How do you speak with someone who you know wants something from you? All of that has to be captured in dialogue. And so we began reading the plays, and I got those first set of 28 dialogues, 28, they weren't scenes, but 3 or 4 pages of dialogue. And in the prison, there's that musty kind of smell. So when I took these stacks of papers home, I would always carry that musty kind of smell of the prison home with me. And I read through them, and there were maybe 4 to 6 absolutely stunning scenes by people who really clearly knew how to write and understood the musicality of language. And indeed, although I didn't know it at the time, what I had were poets and even people who had written books. This went on for 2-3 weeks, and my wife is an actor, graduate of Juilliard, classical actor in New York. She's acted all over the country. And I showed her the scenes, and I said, maybe they could write a play. It wasn't premeditated at all. And I went back and proposed to these students that we take their writings and form them into a play. I was working on a book at the time, which I had to put aside. I'm allowed to add another class to the weekly schedule if students need remedial help. And so, being a bit of a tyrant, I didn't get permission from anyone in the classroom. I signed all 28 students up for remedial help. They did whinge and groan a bit, but they all showed up. So we were doing 2 classes a week. And we had to find a narrative. I was running at the time a weekly meeting on Saturday mornings for formerly incarcerated people out of a church in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And I had run into a young man who had been targeted by police, and I think this is something that people who don't live in these neighborhoods grasp, that young, especially men of color, are preyed upon by police predators over a period of years. So that this young man was told by a certain police officer that he would be the first person to throw him in jail. And how do they do it? They do it by fabricating usually evidence in terms of drugs, planting drugs. That's very common. I had a couple years before, when I was with the New York Times, after I'd come back from overseas, written an investigative story about the Elizabeth Police Department, where there was a secret group within that police department known as the Family, largely white officers. I think they finally admitted a black officer because everybody, even in the police department, realized they were just another iteration of the Klan. It was bizarre, headed by a lieutenant who had reportedly had a giant collection of Nazi memorabilia in his house. They had to swear allegiance on a Yosemite Sam flag. You can't make this stuff up. They used to go into the housing projects with loudspeakers on their squad cars playing Wagner's Song of the Valkyries. And they had a 98% conviction rate because their trunks were filled with drugs that they planted on those they arrested. And I was able to build a relationship with a courageous police officer in the department who funneled me all sorts of internal investigations, grand jury reports, and when I published the story, that lieutenant and several of the people in the family were removed from the force. None of the false convictions, by the way, that they had visited on hundreds of young men were changed or investigated. Indeed, in this class, there was a student from Elizabeth who was falsely charged. He'd been the Golden Gloves champion of the state of New Jersey. He'd been an Army Ranger. And he actually brought that article with him to that first class. So this young man who I interviewed was tackled by police, charged, and they planted drugs on him. And he had a jail sentence. He to this day, wouldn't name the name of this police officer who is now a detective because he feared retribution. And then there was a robbery, and he was coming out of, I believe, a Wendy's or a McDonald's or something. He is a large black man with dreads, and they grabbed him. The person who was robbed said it's them. It wasn't him, but as he said, I fit the description. I was a large black man with dreads. He was Haitian. One of the very difficult things for him was that his mother, who was dying, who he was taking care of, who had cancer, believed that because he was arrested, he was guilty, even though he wasn't. And he, who was the sole breadwinner for the family, he was working, raising his little brother, taking care of his very ill mother, who was about to die, suddenly disappears, swallowed up inside the system of mass incarceration, so the jail system, the prison system. Finances of the family collapse, of course, because it's always so precarious to begin with. And his brother, who he had tried to protect from the streets, goes out and starts to hustle and raises the money to get a lawyer that frees his brother, who is eventually freed, which, as his lawyer said, is in the American legal system the equivalent of a Halley's Comet moment. And he got out, and I taped an interview with him and typed up the transcripts and brought them to the class and said, well, maybe we can build a story around this, which we did. And then we had to begin to flesh everything out. So I remember one class, I said, we need people to write a dialogue about a conversation with your mother. And it doesn't have to be anything dramatic. It could be just a very quiet, tender moment, something you remember. And when we finished the class, one of my students, Timmy, came up to me and said, well, what if we're a product of rape? And I said, well, Timmy, that's what you have to write. And so in this play, everything that eventually was produced in the play happened to someone in the classroom. And what Timmy wrote, and he used his legal name, anyone who's been in a prison system will tell you everybody's got about three names. His legal name was Terrence. What he wrote was set in the county jail, and he had been arrested with his half-brother. And his half-brother had a weapon. And Timmy told the police officers that the weapon was his. And he wrote this phone conversation from the county jail with his mother. And you don't hear his mother's voice. You only hear him. You don't understand, Ma. You're right. Never mind. What do you want me to say, Ma? Ma, they were going to lock up Bruce. The chrome was in the car. Everyone in the car would be charged with murder if no one copped to it. I didn't kill anyone, Ma. Oh, yeah, I forgot. Whenever someone says I did, I did it. I told them what they wanted to hear. That's what the N-word is supposed to do in Newark. I told them what they wanted to hear to keep Bruce out of it. Did they tell you who got killed? Did they say it was my father? Then you should know I didn't do it. If I ever went to jail for anything, it would be killing him. And he ain't dead yet. Rape done brought me into the world, prison gonna take me out, and that's the way it is, Ma. Come on, Ma. If Bruce went to jail, you would have never forgiven me. Me, on the other hand, I wasn't supposed to be here. I'm sorry, Ma, I'm sorry. Don't be crying. You got Bruce, you got him home. He's your baby. Bye, Ma, I'll call you later. He went to prison, as he says, to make sure the son his mother loved stayed home. And at the end of this long process of writing the play, I knew we couldn't read it in front of the other prisoners. There was too much incendiary stuff in there. And so I invited Cornel West and the great theologian James Cone to come be the audience. But when we got to the lobby of the prison, I was with James and Cornell. The warden, the administrator came and said, "You're not going to your classroom. You're going to the chapel." And they escorted us to the chapel. And in the back of the room was a phalanx of white corrections officers. So when my class walked in, they knew immediately what had happened. And they all huddled in the front of the chapel to decide what parts of the play they could read because retribution would be taken out against them and what part they couldn't. And I wanted to listen, but I consciously backed off so that I couldn't hear the discussion, because at that moment, after 4.5 months of work, I realized it was theirs. They owned it. And Timmy got up and read what I read to you. And when the reading was finished, he wasn't there. And I said to everyone, my students, "Where's Timmy?" And they said, "I think he's in the bathroom." And I went and found him huddled, weeping in the corner of the bathroom. Now, one of the things that's important to understand about the American prison system is that the creation of units of isolation, MCUs, was a decision carried out in the early 70s as a way to isolate politically conscious people within the system, especially from the black liberation movements, so that they would come into the prison and immediately be isolated from the rest of the prison population, not for any deletion that they had committed in the prison, because they hadn't even had time to commit any, but because the prison authorities were terrified of radical black figures instilling a kind of consciousness within the rest of the prison population. So all of the members of the Black Panthers, Nation of Islam, Five Percenters, Black Liberation Army, were immediately segregated from the general population. And I knew about one of them, Ojeri Latulo, who's out, lives in Elizabeth, New Jersey, a member of the Black Liberation Army. arrested, in his words, for expropriating money from a capitalist bank for the movement, got in a shootout with, I believe it was Newark police officers. I asked him how it felt. He said, "I felt like the freest black man in America." They put him in isolation for 22 years. And even now, when you're isolated that long, he's obviously brilliant, incredibly well-read, he has trouble communicating because for so long, normal human interaction and communication was denied to him. And yet, he resisted. He refused to wear the uniform. He'd walk around naked. He told the other people on the tier, they have runners. These are people who work on behalf of the administrators who will bring food or distribute or bring the phone down or whatever. He said, "Stop. You don't do that. The guards do that." When they found snitches, there would mysteriously be fires set in their cells until, on his tier, there were no snitches left. And he told me that in order to keep sane, he would have conversations with great revolutionaries like George Jackson. And he said, "I reached a point where I was sitting alone in my cell and I felt like George Jackson was sitting there with me. And I knew that we had to incorporate that story into the play. And so I spent 6 hours interviewing Ogeri. He was wary, of course. I went back to my class. Several of my students knew him. Most of my students had been in Trenton, which is the supermax prison, before they went to the maximum security prison in Rahway. I said, I don't think Ogeri trusts white people. And they said, "No, don't worry, he doesn't trust anybody." And he became what we call the old head. That figure who has been in prison for decades and will probably die in prison, and yet embodies that spirit of resistance. I have visited the great Mumia Abu-Jamal, and on one visit I took Cornell and James Cohn. If you don't know James Cohn, you should. Father of black liberation theology, the only theologian worth reading since maybe Reinhold Niebuhr. Author of The Cross and the Lynching Tree, Martin, Malcolm, and America. The man who condemned the white Christian church as the Antichrist. I took them up to see Mumia and Cornell, who's amazing, had his hands on Mumia's shoulders and said to him, "You have Frederick Douglass in you, brother." Mumia, the tears were running down Mumia's face. August Wilson writes that the greatest blacks, the greatest warriors in the black community are in prison. Because when everything was denied, every avenue was closed, they went out and got for their families what their families needed.
You're listening to Chris Hedges on the prison plantation system. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can get CDs of this program and our special book offer, Noam Chomsky's latest, Consequences of Capitalism. Just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go online. Our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program at no charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977.
I taught the play, and I love August Wilson as a writer. Of course, I admire him, just sheer talent, the lyricism of his writing, which is completely musical. And he uses words in such a way that when you read them off the page, they become a kind of blues anthem. He wrote a play we read called Joe Turner Come and Gone. And August Wilson wrote a cycle of plays, began in 1910 all the way up to the present. His last play, Radio Golf, was about a slick, well-educated black politician like Barack Obama, who did the bidding of the white power elites. But Joe Turner Come and Gone is set in a boarding house in Pittsburgh. Almost all those series of plays are set in Pittsburgh. You may have seen Ma Rainey, Black Bottom, and if you haven't, you should, with the great Viola Davis. And after slavery in the South, the Southern authorities set up a system of convict leasing, which was slavery by another name, except it was worse. Because when a human being was property and worth tremendous sums of money, then it was in your interest to at least keep them alive. But with convict leasing, you seized black bodies. And it didn't matter if you worked them to death. And they were worked to death in the turpentine camps in Florida, on the plantations in Mississippi. And there was a figure, there's a great book by the historian Leon Litwack. He wrote two great books, Ben in the Storm, one on Reconstruction, one on Jim Crow. And he writes about a figure named Turney, who was the, I believe it was Tennessee, I may forget the state, who was the brother of the governor who would put convicts in cuffles, long chains, chained together in pairs, march them through plantation country, and then for a fee, white planters could buy those convicts and work them 5-7 years if they live that long. And there's a blues song called Joe Turner's Come and Gone. And so August Wilson writes about a character in his play who had a young daughter and a wife and was seized. And of course, they were all seized for ridiculous crimes. Not that there aren't ridiculous crimes now that are imposed in poor neighborhoods, mostly to fine poor people, to fill up budget deficits. My favorite being in Ferguson, obstructing pedestrian traffic, which means standing on a sidewalk. And the play is about the arrival of this character who has been enslaved by Joe Turner and comes looking for his wife. And he brings his daughter with him. The woman had gone north and left the girl with her parents. And in that brilliant play by August Wilson, there's a conjurer in the play, and he keeps talking about finding your song. He keeps saying, you must find your song, because if you don't find your song, you're lost. And that's the song of your own history, your own identity, your own experience, your own suffering. And he talks about visions of lakes of bones, skeletal remains of figures that have not found their song, have not put the flesh back on themselves. And it was very clear as I worked with my students on this play that what we were doing in that classroom was writing that song. That song that the wider society, even members of their own family, members in their own community, do not want to hear, much less validate. And all the pain began to pour out. And there's a lot of pain. I had a student, usually they say 5 years, that's when the visits stop. That's about as long as those on the outside can sustain them. Relationships crumble. Many of my students, when they got to prison, immediately told their wives or their girlfriends not to wait for them, to think of them as if they were dead. And my student, one of my students, wrote a scene about visiting his wife and son on a visiting day. And suddenly his little boy, who's about 6, starts talking about Uncle Jimmy. And he realizes that his marriage is over. And the last thing he says to his wife is, "I understand, but at least bring my boy to see me." And he never saw his boy again. And I said, "How old is your son?" And he said, 24. There are big guys in that room. They call it the 400 Club. That's all the guys who bench over 400 pounds. And those exterior shells, which are necessary to protect themselves physically and emotionally, as they wrote this play, as they wrote their song, crumbled into dust. And they would stand in front of that classroom with their hands shaking, reading their truth. A truth not only about them, but about us. A truth that condemns us as a society for the suffering we have visited upon them and their families and their communities. The question was, how would we end this play? There's a code in prisons. Don't be a snitch. Don't cheat other people. Don't lie. One of the things you find about prisons is that, of course, no one touches. And if you touch or bump into someone by mistake, you're immediately, profusely apologetic, unless you want to fight. In fact, prisons are probably one of the politest spots on the planet. And so, in the trajectory of this play, the boy who goes out into the streets to hustle, to get the money for a lawyer, to free his brother, doesn't make it because my student said if he went out into the streets when he was 16, he would have been eaten alive. And so he's killed. And the killer in the play comes to prison. Now, the code of the prison is that it's the duty of the brother to kill the man who killed his brother. That's the code. But my students said that, in fact, that code is ignored more than it's enforced. And that you each pretend that the other doesn't exist. Everything in that play happened to someone in my classroom, including the moment when one of my students is locked in a cell in Trenton and the guard tells him that that was his father's cell. That last night of the class, I held that script in my hand, their song. And I told them, "I don't know anything about producing plays, but I'm going to take it to every theater director I can find to make your song heard." And it was in 2018 produced by the Passage Theater in Trenton, New Jersey, and every single night it was sold out because people in Trenton understand the monstrosity and have suffered from the monstrosity of mass incarceration. And we had one night for the families of my playwrights. And 4 minutes into that play, I heard sniffling and weeping and finally sobbing for the entire 90 minutes. Their song is our song. It's a song about us as a society. A society that has failed the most vulnerable among us. A society whose protean forms of racism and slavery have never changed. Prisons are plantations. They are run like plantations, with white overseers and people of color enslaved, because no prison functions unless the work is done by prisoners. And that's why, to close finally, I believe the only solution to mass incarceration are nationwide prison strikes that demand that those inside prisons earn the minimum wage, instead of, in states like New Jersey, 22 cents an hour, or in states like Georgia, nothing. Over 1 million American prisoners work for for-profit corporations. And indeed, in states like California, they are telling labor-intensive employers, you don't need to produce your products in Bangladesh or Vietnam. We have a bonded labor force. And they can't strike. And you don't pay them for sick days. And you don't have to pay Social Security. And if they're unruly, they disappear. Dostoevsky understood that if you want to understand the heart of any society, you must go inside its prisons. That is where you will see the true face of America. Because what they are doing to them, they seek now to do to the rest of us. It's been certainly one of the greatest honors of my life to be with these students. I do not believe that I could have undergone what they underwent and become who they have become. Men, and I have taught in the women's prison, and women of dignity, brilliance, and integrity, an integrity formed in the chains that we put around them. Thank you.
So is there anyone in the audience who would like to ask Chris a question right now about the writing of the book, the process of the class?
First of all, thank you for the work that you've done in the schools and your contribution to everything that I know that those prisoners cherish while they're in there in that world. I'm a formerly incarcerated individual. I think I've stayed about 17 of my 39 on this planet here in New York State. I probably know the answer to this, but I know that a lot of other people might not know. What were the challenges that you had? Did you face any backlash from security guards, correction staffs, and what was it? How bad did it get?
That's a good question. You understand the system. They hate the teachers. And that they know that if they treat the teachers the way they treat the families, they won't have teachers in the prison. So it's been a constant battle. And it's a constant battle for us to retain professors, because you don't get rewarded in academic apartments for teaching in a prison. You get rewarded for writing books or papers or attending conferences. And of course, logistically, you have to be there an hour before. This was a common occurrence in Wagner, where there'd be lockdowns because of altercations in the prison, so I could be sitting in that classroom for an extra 2 hours until there was movement in the halls. So yes, there's an anger on the part of the guards that we're giving a college education to people they demonize and despise. There's a constant expressions of hostility. And, you know, we have to, I always feel like when I go in the prison, I have to put on my step and fetch it act. Because even if they're provoking you, you can't respond, which is also true for my students. And they will seek to provoke you. So, yeah, there's a hostility to the program. I will say that it's gotten better because, for instance, in East Jersey State Prison, we have 140 students in the college program, but we have several hundred who want to get in. It's quite a rigorous admission process. And you can't get in if you've got charges, if you've had problems within the prison, if your record isn't clean. And so, in fact, behavior, because people want to get an education, has improved, and therefore corrections officers don't have to carry out as much draconian force because people are trying to get into the program. But yes, and we have in the, I have taught in the Supermax prison, but they won't put the college program in there because, in the words of a corrections official, they're all going to die in there anyway, which for me is fails to understand the importance of the system, because in many ways, what we're trying to do is create teachers, people who build an education and are within that system. And in my last class that I taught, I had two students who graduated from Rutgers summa cum laude, who were my teaching assistants. And I had a student, he's out, thank God. I had a student, he was arrested at the age of 14 in Camden, New Jersey, for a crime he did not commit. His parents were dead. He was living in an abandoned house. He was 90 pounds, barely illiterate, accused of a murder and a rape, and taken into a room by three burly, large Camden City police detectives, forced to sign a confession, which he didn't even know what was in it. He gets to court. He hears it. He tries to protest. It's his, I think, very true claims that he didn't know what he had signed his name to are dismissed by the judge, and he was sentenced as a 14-year-old boy to a term where he could not go before the parole board until he was 70 years old. And he is one of my best students. If I would even mention a book, and these people have very little money and resources, he would try and get it and read it. I taught a course called Conquest, a history course. We read Open Veins of Latin America, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, and C.L.R. James's Black Jacobins on the Haitian slave revolt, the only successful slave revolt in human history, which Haiti has been paying for ever since. And at the end of the class left, and he came up to me and he said, "I know I'm going to die here in this prison, but I work as hard as I do because one day I'm going to be a teacher like you." And he walked out. And people often ask me about hope. That's hope for me. I can live off of that for a long time. Does it change the world? Does it overthrow the system of injustice? No. And through a courageous public attorney, we got him into a resentencing hearing because of his sentencing as a juvenile, and he has no family. And so I went, and I am an ordained Presbyterian minister. He's Muslim. And I put on my clerical collar, which I never wear, and I went to that courtroom, and they don't tell you what case, or we didn't know, those of us in the watching the hearings and trials, none of us knew who was coming next. And I got there at 10 in the morning, and I sat there until late afternoon until I was the only one left. And the sheriff's deputy would open the door to let the prisoner into the court, shackled, of course. And at the end of the day, he opens the door to let Lawrence in and sees that the only one there is this white guy in a clerical collar. He said, "Who's that f***ing minister?" And Lawrence goes, "That's my pastor." And that, for me, is what ministry is about. I'm not trying to bring anyone to Jesus. I'm trying to show them what a life of faith is about. And that means standing with the crucified of this earth. And if necessary, you must be willing to be crucified with them. I once asked Daniel Berrigan, the great radical priest, how he defined faith. He said, the belief that the good draws to it the good, even if empirically everything around us says otherwise. And Lawrence is out. And he had no family or money, and so we raised money to get him an apartment, and my garage was filled with donated furniture, all from formerly incarcerated people. And he graduated in December, summa cum laude from Rutgers.
How do you think you achieved like that level of vulnerability?
It wasn't easy, because in order to survive in that environment, you have to have a very thick protective shell. My friend Ron Pierce, who was in for 31 years, said, you know, when a family member dies, when you suffer grief, you got to do your grieving alone. He said, you can't put any more grief on these brothers. This is a house of grief. I think because I was honest, because I didn't pretend to be anything I wasn't, because I didn't try to be cool, because I didn't pretend that I knew where they came from, and I think because they sensed that I truly cared, and I do care. I mean, to be honest, every class, my last class in every prison, I cry. And nobody ever cries in a prison except me. I cry because I leave them behind. People sometimes say, how do you keep going? What keeps you? I said, anger. If you walk out of that prison and you're not angry, you don't have a heart. But it was a gradual process that those walls broke down slowly. But of course, it's trust. And in a prison environment, people are very wary of trusting anyone. But I think they knew that I was real, that I was genuine, that I cared, and that I wasn't afraid to show that I cared. Thank you, and thanks, Sanctuary. Do great work. Keep it up. The work that the Sanctuary does in Troy, I think, is a model in many ways for the kind of grassroots community organizing and education and celebration of those voices that, of course, corporate media has locked out and corporate forces are attempting to subjugate. We really have to build from the ground up, and Sanctuary is doing that. Thank you.
You were just listening to Chris Hedges on the prison plantation system. He spoke at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on June 28, 2021. Chris Hedges is an award-winning journalist and author. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're independent and in our 36th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such progressive voices as Cornel West, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Winona LaDuke, Arundhati Roy, Ralph Nader, Angela Davis, and Michael Eric Dyson. And we have a series of programs with Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of today's program with Chris Hedges, and for our special book offer, Noam Chomsky's latest, Consequences of Capitalism, just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977, or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program at no charge. Call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Bob Dylan singing Hurricane. Pistol shots ring out in a barroom night into Betty Bell.
bartender in a pool of blood. Cries out, my God, they've killed them all. Here comes the story of the hurricane. The man the authorities came to blame for something that he never done. Put in a prison cell, but one time he could have been the champion of the world.
RCT, Pittsburgh.
Ain't no time for education. Too much corn in the field. Ain't got time to go to school, y'all. We got too much work around here.
Yeah.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
You are listening to the Tenbo Sounds, the culture show.
Righteousness.